Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Before we get into specifics drawn from the interests of Flannery O'Connor, I'm going to go touch on some principles in tonight's talk about the philosophy of art. And I've given these in more detail in other Thomistic Institute lectures. Not to plug myself here, but you can find those lectures, ones on the beautiful and the sublime, the role of poetry in the Christian life, and other talks on Dante, Chaucer, and other authors on the Thomistic Institute podcast. And while I'm plugging the Thomistic Institute podcast, check it out. In addition to my own feeble attempts, there are some first-rate Dominicans and Catholic faculty giving free lectures out there. This talk is my first attempt at a closing chapter to a book that I've been working on Thomistic approaches to literature and their place in Christian anthropology. I'm going to do my best here to stop myself and explain what I've assumed in this talk from chapters that are in the previous part of the book, but there's going to be time after this in the Q&A if there's anything that's unclear. Well, I have some show and tell over here. I'm going to bring these out at various points. Other books, work by Flannery O'Connor and her letters. For those who didn't get too much into the biography and didn't know much more about Flannery O'Connor, she was born and raised in Savannah, Georgia in 1925. In her early teens, her father passed away from complications from lupus, and the family moved to her mother's farmhouse in rural Georgia in a town called Milledgeville in 1938, so her early teens. She would go on to graduate from Georgia State College for Women in 1945, and from there, perhaps arguably the most important phase and turning point in her life, she went to the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop. Today, University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop is a huge, big deal, right? For those who are in the creative writing world, it still is a sort of powerhouse. But this was the sort of moment in time in the 20th century where figures in the American literary scene were certainly making it the powerhouse that it is today and gaining its reputation. As an aside, if you want a portrait of her inner spiritual life during this time, recently published, there's been a prayer journal and includes both facsimile copies of the prayer journal, which is actually just a very humble marble notebook. So for all those kids who I see in the chapel these days with all their colored pens and their like $50 leather journal binder and stuff like that, if a marble notebook that's like a dollar from the drugstore is good enough for Flannery O'Connor, it's probably good enough for you. So this prayer journal is a copy of what she kept from January 1946 to September 1947. It's good devotional reading. It's also just good reading as an insight into the spirituality of her. After Iowa, she had some stories in her first novel, Wise Blood, published. She then suffered mightily for almost a decade from the same disease, lupus, that took her father. In addition to all the other various symptoms, it left her bone structure brittle and required the use of crutches. So many of the later photos that people see of Flannery O'Connor in her later years is her on those two crutches. And she'll talk in her letters at times about just, you know, these various problems and complications she's having with the disease. A family relative left them some money that afforded them a trip to Lourdes. And it actually seemed to have some sort of marked improvement. She was able for a time to walk around without crutches around the house, but the disease continued and eventually she died at the young age of 39. During the years after Iowa and Wise Blood, O'Connor worked steadily on her fiction, gave speeches, some of which are preserved in second part of the show and tell. It's an excellent, if you're looking for something to read this summer, get yourself a group. Mystery and Manners is a number of these occasional talks that have been reworked into a published nonfiction book. And they're quite good. And then she also kept up during this time a voluminous correspondence. So she made all these friends all across the country in the writing world, Andrew Lytle, Caroline Gordon, people like the Fitzgeralds. And she kept up this correspondence even though her disease kept her from traveling as much. And all of that's been preserved and published in this easy, you know, summer afternoon, single sit down and read volume over here. So The Habit of Being, which is a fantastic little book. So if that didn't paint a clear enough picture for you of her life, and I'm just going to move on after that. This month, of all coincidences, so this is even before you had extended the invitation, which is months ago, this month is the release date for Wildcat, which is the new biopic movie. Ethan Hawke is directing it. I believe his daughter, whose name I forget, but I'm sure that she'll become a famous actress someday. Maya Hawke. Okay, there we go. I've done her wrong. I will write an apology right now. Maya Hawke is starring as Flannery O'Connor, and at least from the trailer, she does a pretty good impression, and it seems quite fantastic. So can't go from it tonight. I think it's another 2 weeks until the premiere, but you should go see it. All right, so let's first focus on the influence of St. Thomas Aquinas on Flannery O'Connor, now that we have a picture of who she is. Assuming that most of you are members of the Thomistic Institute, you know more about St. Thomas Aquinas. The man needs no introduction, hopefully. The most popular thing known, indeed the title of this talk, so if you go on the Thomistic Institute website, they call it Beyond Hillbilly Thomism, right? So the title of the talk alludes to this. This is the idea that Flannery O'Connor was in the habit of referring to herself as a quote-unquote hillbilly Thomist. In fact, many of the Dominican friars who give lectures for and work for the Thomistic Institute are part of a popular band. You can find them on Spotify, YouTube. I have friends sometimes who are at summer conferences, and they're like, the talks were great, but it was fantastic when the Dominican friars busted out the banjos and the hillbilly Thomists performed. So you can go listen to them as well. And it's a fun title, and it's a fun idea, this idea of a hillbilly Thomist. And what does that mean? The actual context for the phrase comes from a letter dated from May 18th, 1955. So it's not like she like had this tattooed on herself or like made t-shirts that said hillbilly Thomas, okay? It's a throwaway phrase used in a single letter. But in that letter, she's discussing an upcoming television interview about Wise Blood. The pertinent passage runs thus. Everybody who has read Wise Blood thinks I'm a hillbilly nihilist, whereas I would like to create the impression over the television that I'm a hillbilly Thomist. But I will probably not be able to think of anything to say to Mr. Harvey Bright, but, huh? And, don't know. So the danger here in reading this and extracting the phrase hillbilly Thomas out of that is that we're removing it from sort of self-deprecating humor that is of the fashion of Flannery O'Connor. O'Connor was a Thomas, but her Thomas was very urban. And if you read the letters, it's francophilic. There are constant references to Thomists in the 20th century, like Étienne Gilson, Jacques Maritain. And so she would spend about 30 minutes every day for a period of her life in her early 20s just reading St. Thomas Aquinas. I don't know what you guys are doing, just doom scrolling on whatever social media platform you have or TikTok. You could be reading Thomas Aquinas, right? And if you're not doing that, some of you need to invent the social media app that lets people just swipe right to meet more questions, right? You know, just swipe right for the said contra, okay? She spent about 30 minutes every day reading Thomas Aquinas, and this is reflected in her letters. They're peppered throughout. If you go to the index of Flannery O'Connor's letters, the references to St. Thomas Aquinas are one of the most numerous, okay? The hillbilly aspect is a kind of modest acknowledgement of the degree or standard that she held up against herself. So it's this kind of modest acknowledgement or the degree, the standard that she holds herself up against, right? It's this self-deprecating comment that is about more the way that she sees herself portrayed on television than more about the way that she sees herself in actuality. So in a letter from 6 years later, in 1961, writing to a different friend, Flannery O'Connor says, I'm a Thomas three times removed and live amongst many distinctions. And I think this is a more true definition of the way that Flannery O'Connor saw herself as a Thomist. And she has this parenthetical remark that explains it. A Thomist three times removed is one who, number one, doesn't read Latin, or St. Thomas, but gets it by osmosis. And there, it's kind of a reflection of her own attempts at reading St. Thomas, and then only having portions of St. Thomas make sense when filtered through commentaries and you know, these modern authors like Gilson and Maritain. That she didn't read St. Thomas Aquinas in Latin is true, but that she didn't read St. Thomas himself is a straight-up deflection of facts. Time and again in her letters, she makes distinctions. She will consult with a friend on a specific virtue, and she'll have, just off the top of her head, the exact passage in St. Thomas of, this is what St. Thomas says about the number of ways that we can exercise charity in this particular scenario. you don't get that without being a keen reader of St. Thomas. You don't get that from being a hillbilly Thomist or a Thomist 3 degrees removed. She's a keen lover of St. Thomas Aquinas, and as she herself says, one of the reasons she loves God is because she loves St. Thomas. Again, it's this the modern phenomenon of, like, what do we call it in schools, like tryhards, right? You don't want to be seen as someone who attempts to show too much effort, right? And there's sort of a distance that you want to put yourself between that, right, to make the art seem artless. There's a danger of an imagining and trusting the author with every word that she says about herself, right? And so taking everything on this face value when there's very clear jibes that she's having in the text. Another instance of this that puts it in light regarding St. Thomas Aquinas, and trust me, we'll move on and we'll get into the actual things that she's concerned about St. Thomas Aquinas, but it doesn't strike me well that we all run around calling ourselves hillbilly Thomas. So she says in another letter dated 1955, I suppose I read Aristotle in college, but not to know I was doing it. The same with Plato. I don't have the mind that can carry such beyond the actual reading, right? So she reads it, but she doesn't feel like she's really acquired it. That is, a total non-retention has kept my education from being a burden to me. So I couldn't make any judgment on the Summa except to say this. I read it for about 20 minutes every night before I go to bed. If my mother were to come in during this process and say, turn off that light, it's late, I, with lifted finger and broad, bland, beatific expression, would reply, on the contrary, I answer that the light, being eternal and luminous, cannot be turned off. Shut your eyes, or some such thing. Again, there's the humor. It's very clear, even in my poor presentation of it, right? And she goes on to say, in any case, I feel I can personally guarantee that St. Thomas loved God because for the life of me, I cannot help loving St. Thomas. His brothers didn't want him to waste himself being a Dominican, and so locked him up in a tower and introduced a prostitute into his apartment. Her, he ran out with a red-hot poker. It would be fashionable today to be in sympathy with the woman, but I am in sympathy with St. Thomas. So this is very much the attitude of Flannery O'Connor, right? She is not one to mince words. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip over this other section, but again, if you pick up The Habit of Being, just flip open the index, and just there's a wealth of treasure of her aside comments of the utility of St. Thomas Aquinas for all sorts of situations in life. I don't know how it would feel to be on the receiving end of this, right? Like, hey, I was thinking about publishing on this. What do you think? And then you get a treatise on St. Thomas Aquinas written back to you in response. I want dinner on Tuesday. What did Thomas Aquinas says about gluttony? Send it back to you, right? But it's all pervasive in her thought. And you're not going to see that in the stories, obviously. In a story like Parker's Back, right? Temple of the Holy Ghost, right? You're not going to have her quoting Thomas Aquinas, but it suffuses her thought. And I want to make sure that we're grounded in this idea that she is a very deep and broad reader of St. Thomas Aquinas. So what does it matter that Flannery O'Connor was a great reader and devotee of Thomas? Here, I want to return to her own phrase that she picked up from St. Thomas via osmosis and mention that she is quite explicit in her other letters and nonfiction about the debt that she owes to St. Thomas Aquinas. And this is through Jacques Maritain's book, Art and Scholasticism. It's a fantastic book. It's a very thin book. It's much thinner than this book, right? You could read it if you had a devoted afternoon to do it and a couple of cups of coffee. But Art and Scholasticism was this book that was quite popular in its day, is popular still in certain Catholic circles, less so now. It's one of these things where you find Maritain fans and sort of like gather together like conspirators, right? You still read Maritain? So very quickly, for those unfamiliar with Maritain, he lived from 1882 to 1973, and arguably is one of the most important Thomistic philosophers and theologians of the 20th century. I say arguably because we're on the Fordham campus. I imagine we could dig up a few SJs who might also be in the running for best theologian of the 20th century. But nonetheless, he wrote on a vast number of topics in philosophy and the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. And it's really astounding to meet Maritain enthusiasts today because of their diversity. Sometimes you'll be in these odd, political philosophy conferences, and you find the Maritain scholar, and they're plopped down in there. Sometimes you'll be at a liturgy conference, and there's Maritain scholars holding forth over there. And then sometimes you're hanging out with Catholic poets and publishers, and they think that Maritain solely and only wrote on art. So it's kind of one of these things where everyone's getting a bit of the elephant, if you know the metaphor, right? A much larger thinker than most people reduce him to today. But it is on art and art and scholasticism that Flannery O'Connor really found something that connected her love of St. Thomas Aquinas with what she was struggling with and attempting to do in her art. The idea that sticks there is that St. Thomas Aquinas is going to define art as a virtue of the practical intellect. And here, see, it finally came into play, okay? The practical intellect as a rational power. And that art is an end in and of itself and does not derive its good from the morals of the author. And so for her, this is quite interesting because it ties in with one of the other things that is repeated throughout her letters. Constantly to friends, she talks about, of all the virtues, the one that is most important to her is prudence. Prudence as a virtue. And one of the connections, and the thing that I think I have that's new and is worth sharing with people, is that there is not really an explicit connection made in Flannery O'Connor's discussion of prudence with her way of picking up St. Thomas Aquinas on art. And yet if you read St. Thomas Aquinas on the practical intellect, you understand that the practical intellect, as a power of the soul, is what is concerned both with prudence and with art. So just to, for time's sake, to make sure that nothing's going over our heads, right? Thomas Aquinas is going to pick up an anthropology that is indebted in large parts both to Plato and to Aristotle. If you really want to get into this and understand the beginnings of this anthropology, you could read the De Anima by Aristotle, where you have the three major divisions that I've outlined here, vegetative powers, which really don't get a whole lot of time and energy and Aquinas devoted to them. Again, like no one really wins awards for the vegetative powers, right? We don't define that as the best part of the human soul, right? Reproduction, growth, nutrition. I mean, we have pie eating contests, but we really don't like write newspaper articles about like, you know, local man has child, or well, local, you know, family has child or something like this, right? It's not like something that is newsworthy unless like you're really rich and you force the newspaper to publish it. And then we have animal powers that are defined in terms of locomotion and sensation. And there we have power. Again, all of these are cohabiting inside the soul, right? That is, just because we're human beings and we have rational powers doesn't mean that we don't also have vegetative or animal powers. And so with the animal powers, we have sense appetites and sense knowledge. And the idea being that there are some things that we can do inside the animal powers that are a little different because we have reason as well, as St. Thomas Aquinas is going to talk about. But to jump up to the rational powers, which is what Flannery and Thomas are talking about, the rational powers, you have the intellect. And in the intellect, you have both a speculative and a practical intellect. So for St. Thomas Aquinas, if you've never encountered this, the speculative intellect would understand the idea of health, right? What is the idea of what it means to be and possess health? General principles of fitness and these sorts of things. The practical intellect is concerned with taking and applying whatever I know in the speculative with what is actually happening in reality, right? So I got on a very early flight today to get here into New York, right? And so I have a speculative idea of health, and I know that I am really tired and I should be sleeping more, right? That's one practical thing. So a practical part that I could take in that is getting a nap on the plane. I tried that, didn't really work. Right. Another aspect is the idea of health is, again, like nutrition. Yeah. And so I have a idea of health. My doctor has an idea of health for me now that I'm older. It involves watching cholesterol. But I also maybe didn't listen to my practical intellect today and went to Pugsley's instead and had a couple slices from Sal. Right. And so there is this idea of, okay, well, do I eat like, fruits and vegetables? Right. And that's the practical choice. Or the speculative idea of thinking about what is the broader concept at hand, right? And so what's interesting here is that while philosophy and other things are more concerned with the speculative, it is in art that the practical comes out and shines forth, right? And so art then is a practical application and it is a making, but unlike other things that are making, we do it as an end in and of itself, which raises it up and elevates it above other things that we do, right? So I eat so that I can, you know, live. Again, the ways that we can reduce these things, right? You write the essay in order to get the grade, right? Now that's a way where you reduce an intellectual exercise not to be an end in and of itself, but now make it a mean towards some sort of end. Oftentimes, as universities are run today, this is what you'll encounter, right? Why are you here? We met one student today who's studying both philosophy and, was it business management? So there we have it, right? That is concerned with things that are ends in and of themselves and concerns with things that are means towards some sort of end, right? Philosophy, end in and of itself, right? Business management, means towards some end. I don't think I had to spell it out, but yeah, there we go. Great. Okay. To beat the dead horse. To understand this, right, in the making that it is in and of itself, there are two important aspects of what makes good art that Flannery O'Connor is going to pick up from St. Thomas Aquinas, and it is the subject of some other things that I've talked about before. Number one, is this art beautiful? Right? And so for St. Thomas Aquinas, there are three qualifications that define something as beautiful, and it depends on the thing, what this is, but categorically what it is, that it has a sense of proportion, right? That it has clarity to it, and that it has size or greatness. So, I mean, we take, for example, what is above us, right? This reproduction of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. It is a reproduction of the actual ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. I would say one is beautiful. The other puts us in mind and is a means towards the end of thinking about the actual ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, right? When you look at it, again, I'm not trying to nitpick here, but like if you've actually been inside the Sistine Chapel, you go through those three things, proportionality is part of the beauty of it, and you're missing that when you just get the ceiling. One thing about the proportionality of this is seeing how it fits into the very architecture of the chapel itself. And again, like very obvious things that are meant to resonate and give meaning to it are missing when you just take the ceiling by itself. So for example, you know, Michelangelo will later come in and finish this part towards where I am is the altar, right? And it's the Christ coming in the last judgment. And so certain things don't seem to make sense if you look at it this way without seeing the whole, right? So if you look at the Sistine Chapel, you have in nine panels the story of creation, right? God separating the light from the darkness, creating the sun and the earth, and then bringing forth life, and then the story of Noah. And what you have there is a story from God in his eternity, creating things, flowing out from there, and the sinfulness and fall of man as sort of a crux or a turning point. And notice that what you're missing in the proportionality and understanding the beauty of it is the fact that Michelangelo is composing it in situ, right, in the place in the chapel. So where is God present? At the altar, right? So where do we have the beginnings of the Genesis narrative in the Sistine Chapel, right? With where things are good in the beginning, right? And things get progressively worse and worse. And then if you go down in the Sistine Chapel and look on the side walls, in the century before Michelangelo, there were a series of frescoes that were done that are of the life, on the one hand, of Moses and the life of Christ, leading from their infancy over at the end towards their adulthood over here at the altar. And so if you follow this, right, you have a story that is incomplete if you just have the ceiling, right? So there's something missing from the beauty of the Sistine Chapel ceiling because it's not just a ceiling, it's part of a whole, right? That is, it's a narrative that is integrated with the Mass and the liturgy, going from God creating everything good in the beginning to the summation and the eschatological, that is, end-time understanding of the Mass as being something that is both a reproduction and a recapitulation of the sacrifice of both Holy Thursday and Good Friday and the triumph of Easter, but also an eschatological understanding of it as the end time, right? Which is why, without going into too much, you have the idea of like a basilica, right? Where the judge sits in Roman basilicas, where the judge sits and gives out his decrees. And in our Catholic churches, we have basilicas where at the throne of judgment, the judge comes, and this is the missing panel here, is the last judgment, right? So it's missing part of its proportionality. There's also like, you know, some photographic you know, you have to stand at the right angle from this thing to actually make it make sense. But there is a clarity to it. It's obviously based off of the retouchings that they did in the late 20th century of the Sistine Chapel that brought the vibrancy and the color back into the painting. And what's missing as well is the other part that St. Thomas Aquinas would talk about, which is the magnitude of it, right? The sort of like you're standing before it and it just overwhelms you with awe, right? Same way that like you can go into the Accademia in Florence and see the actual David, and part of the beauty of it is the size of it. And then you get like the little gift shop version of the David, and it's not quite the same, right? Not quite the same. So when it comes to you as a human being, St. Thomas Aquinas will say, right, you have proportionality, you have physical proportionality, but you also have proportionality of your virtues, right? You have a clarity of the soul, right? We know, and I think we can sense when we meet good people, there's something about them that shines. For St. Thomas Aquinas, he calls this the virtue of honesty, and it shines forth in people. And then there is a greatness to people, right? A lack of what we call pusillanimity, right? Sort of pettiness that some people have of just like getting bogged down in the little stuff. So all of this is part of the beauty of the person. When it comes to beauty in the art, these are all standards that are to be held. Now, the other thing that gets overlooked all the time and helps make sense of why Flannery O'Connor is so good is that she not only is trying to make something beautiful, she is also trying to make something that is sublime. For some reason, the graph didn't actually line up here. My apologies. If you've read your Aristotle Nicomachean Ethics, you know that any virtue stands opposed to an excess and a deficiency. Ancient theories of the idea of the sublime, the idea of tahupsa, that is that which lifts you up above, right, about a work of art, are distinguished and separate from, although complementary to, the beautiful. And so there is what is called the puerile. I think I have an example here. Something is sublime, Shakespeare, right? To be or not to be, that is the question, right? This opening of this salvo for this great monologue is itself sublime, right? To reduce it in its context, to try to make it more intelligible, digestible, whatever you want to say, is to interject a kind of puerility, a childishness, right? A lack of like maturity, as it were, right? To say, the question is to be or not to be, right? Solved it, done, move on. Next thing, right? Why are we bothering to read Shakespeare still, right? And then this is the no fear Shakespeare version. The question is it better to be alive or dead, right? Which obviously is a philosophical question, loses so much of the weight of what's really being asked in this, right? And on the other hand, you could go too much in the other direction and make it, to rail on tryhards, there's too much effort shown into it to the point that you obscure the point, right? So you, instead of saying to be or not to be, that is the question. Ah, yes, verily. The question, the rogation, and then you just go through the source and go through all the synonyms, right? And you just want to show people how smart you are and how many things you know and obscure the point through adding too muchness to all of this, right? And so this is something that Thomas Aquinas is going to bring up. This is something that Flannery O'Connor is going to take in. And when you think about some of the great play short stories that we have, I want to take, for example, Parker's Back, right? So there's a story that you all read. Yeah. So if you go into Parker's Back, there are not very beautiful things depicted in Parker's Back, right? There are people who do not shine forth in their virtue, right? There are actions like getting drunk, the quasi-blasphemous idea of getting a Byzantine icon of Jesus Christ tattooed onto your back, right, is not necessarily beautiful, right? And I don't imagine that whatever backwater town that he got it done in was a very beautiful tattoo parlor, right? There are moments that are not beautiful, but there are moments of sublimity in the text. What is the sublime, right? So we'd be clear about what we're talking about, right? Number one, it has to contain great thoughts. Number two, it has to be vehement and enthusiastic passions that are portrayed, right? And so in Parker's Back, you certainly have that, right? You have this sort of compelling passion that is moving this character, right? The figures of thought, right? That is the actual words that you use, The figures of speech and the arrangement are also part of that as well. This is pulled from Pseudo-Longinus, but this is also pulled up in scholastic commentaries as well. So it's all part of the larger thing that Maritain is drawing from when he's writing his book, Art and Scholasticism, which is what Flannery O'Connor is getting her ideas from. And the idea is that some of these are given by nature, or as Flannery O'Connor would say, by God. And you can really read these in her prayer journal as she's writing in the Iowa Writer's Studio, just alone with God, asking and praying that she write well and that she offer up something good, but knowing that God has to give her the grace to do it. But then knowing as well that she has to actually put in the work, right? That she actually has to do her part on what she can manage in terms of sublimity of, you know, working on the thought, the speech, the diction that she uses and employs. The point of all of it is, as an end in and of itself, right, it has a beauty and sublimity. But the delight that can come through it, so it's a secondary end, is that it can shock the person into wonder, right? And shocking you into wonder, as these neo-scholastic philosophers would say, for example, you read Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, right? This idea of wonder as a principle in Etienne Jusson and Maritain and Pieper, the authors that O'Connor is reading, is this fundamental thing that we are trying to arouse in the human person that helps lead to God, right? We live in this sort of, again, and O'Connor is wrestling with this. You know, is she just a romantic, right? Or is she something more? And so to avoid the romanticism, she wants to shock you, not necessarily with what is beautiful, into a contemplation of some deeper mystery of what you don't know, in the hopes that it will stir up a hope or a desire for you of that. We live in this post-Enlightenment disenchanted world. Again, this is O'Connor and other people's conception of it, right? And so because we live in this disenchanted world, you know, the one solution is romanticism, to sort of like bury your head in the sand, their view of romanticism, not necessarily mine, and to go back to a storied past, or to plow through and to see the way that the sublime breaks through even in our modern world, even in the world of cell phones and social media and the mundane, the ways in which we absolutely take for granted the sort of magical things that happen. The fact that I can be in Lincoln, Nebraska this morning and be with you at this point today is something that for centuries of humankind we didn't fathom, right? Some sort of magical power must be at work, and we seem to take it for granted, right? And what happens with that as well is a lack of or a cheapening of the world around us, because if it's all unknowable, it leads to despair, right? If you have a sense of the world around you and it's unknowable and you don't have any desire to know it, you're going to despair. Parker's Back is a exercise in that, right? There is a man who is completely restless. He doesn't know what to do with himself, tried out any number of different things in his life, and yet is still God-haunted. And so this moment of grace breaks in, and there's not really a clear resolution. Again, it's the dissatisfaction that O'Connor leaves us with, because she's not going to give us sort of a plastic saint, right? Parker's Back ends with his wife looking at this image of the Jesus Christ on her back, taking the broom out and beating the crud out of him, right? Until he's bleeding and he's crying, right? And it's not like, wow, this moment of grace and everything was wonderful in his life. Sort of like, you know, prosperity gospel type moment. What Flannery O'Connor is doing what art is supposed to do, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, right? To be a thing of beauty in and of itself. And if it has some sort of secondary end, it's a kind of corn kernel stuck in your tooth that leaves you discontent and wondering about things and sets in sort of an inner motion so that your sympathy starts to align with the art and the world around you. This is at least my theory of what's going on from reading her and both the stories and the nonfiction text. But also then it becomes a sort of a beautiful way of understanding what the artist is about in the world. W.H. Auden, in his poem In Memory of W.B. Yeats, talks about it this way, that poetry survives a way of being a mouth, right? It accomplishes nothing, however much you try to commercialize it. You try to commercialize it, it turns into jingles, right? And it ceases to be true poetry. And so poetry then, and good literature, serves this end that is aligned with the spirit of the human being, right? And to sort of draw it to a conclusion, leave time for Q&A here, Flannery talks about the fact that she's writing for agnostics and fallen away people. And one of the things that she leaves, and again in her letters, is the idea that whether you are a Christian or not, we both worship the God who is. St. Thomas on his deathbed said of the Summa, it's all straw. This was in the vision of that God. And so as she surveys and wrestles with the value of her own art, there is a kind of positive statement when you say it's all straw. To say that it's all straw is to say that it is all meaningless. To say that it's meaningless in this limited context in aesthetic philosophy is to say that it is not a means towards some sort of end. So that's the beauty then that I see in Flannery O'Connor. And with that, I'm going to be quiet and let you guys ask some questions if you have any. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.